Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Accent 67, the symposium this year discussing the question, the responsibility of dissent. Tonight, I'd like to present to you some outstanding members of our Accent 67 Executive Committee. First, Mr. Frank Shepherd, who has been in charge of our high school and junior college students. Frank, would you stand up, please? Next, Mr. Steve Smith, who is in charge of public relations. Steve? Next, we have Wayne Rich, program director. Wayne? Steve Schultz, the ever-important finance chairman. Steve? Mr. Bill Haverfield, who is vice chairman of Accent. Bill? Dean Franklin Doty, who is our faculty member on Accent Executive Committee. Charles Shepherd, chairman of Accent. Charles? Tonight we are indeed fortunate to have two very distinguished people besides the distinguished people that I've introduced to you prior to this statement. And if you want to digest that. Dr. J. Wayne Wright has served the University of Florida almost 12 years. He has been a long friend of mine, an outstanding citizen of the state of Florida, the most important fighter and greatest fighter of higher education in our state, and I feel in our nation. It's indeed a great pleasure for me to present to him, or present him to you, for the last time that I will do in my reign as president of the student body, and I know he'll be grateful for that. He has been today in Tallahassee fighting the battle of the budget and has returned, I hope, victorious. I present to you the president of the University of Florida, Dr. J. Wayne Wright. Dr. Wright.
Thank you very much, Buddy Jacobs. Contrary to what you say, I wish you could stay around a great deal longer. You have been a great president of this student body, and you followed in a rich tradition of other great presidents of this student government. And I am particularly pleased that you have been assisted with such able associates, including Charles Shepherd, your colleagues and student government, in organizing and presenting this Accent program, which we believe is exceedingly well balanced and very stimulating to this student body, faculty, and community. And so I want to congratulate you and commend you for having made these few days possible. We are highly honored to have as our guest speaker this evening one of our nation's distinguished citizens, the 36th Vice President of the United States, the Honorable Richard N. Nixon. A native of California, as you know, Mr. Nixon was graduated from Whittier College. And I am pleased to note, Mr. Nixon, that you, like many other outstanding citizens of this country, have seen fit to serve your alma mater as a member of the Board of Trustees. Such unselfish service given so freely is absolutely essential to the betterment of higher education in this country. Following his graduation from Whittier College, Mr. Nixon received his LLB from the Duke School of Law in 1937. Immediately thereafter, he was associated with the Office of Emergency Management in Washington, serving as an attorney from 1937 to 1942. Like so many young Americans of that day, he had his career interrupted by World War II, in which he served with distinction as a lieutenant commander in the United States Navy. Returning to California, his native state, at the close of the war, he was elected Republican representative from the 12th Congressional District in 1946, and was returned to the Congress in 1948 without opposition. In 1950, as you will recall, he was elected to the Senate of the United States, and then was selected as the vice presidential running mate of General Dwight Eisenhower, and was elected by a decisive margin. Mr. Nixon's service to his country as vice president is well known to all of us, and we remember, among other things, with pleasure, his courage demonstrated during the Latin American tour on the one hand, and his determination, which was so outstanding in debate with Premier Khrushchev at another time, to mention only two of many events that we could recall with pleasure. We above all, Mr. Nixon, in this particular setting tonight, recall our very pleasant visit with you, I believe, in early 1960. When you came to this campus and with a very large audience and a few opening remarks, then you subjected yourself to a panel of on the platform asking you questions at the end of an hour and a half. We were delighted and pleased with the manner in which you had so effectively handled yourself. We were delighted with that occasion. We also recall, too, that you left here and went to Miami shortly thereafter and made a very important announcement. We are so pleased to have you here tonight, and it is an honor and a privilege to present you again to this University of Florida audience. The platform is yours, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, Dr. Reitz, President Jacobs, all of the distinguished guests of the platform, and all of you who are attending this accent program tonight at the University of Florida. As I stand here before you, I have many pleasant memories of my previous visit here in the year 1960. That, as you may recall, was a rather significant year for me. And as Dr. Reitz was introducing me so eloquently and perhaps over generously, I was reminded of what a great diplomat he is. He mentioned the success of my debate with Mr. Khrushchev. He did not mention the debate with President Kennedy. He mentioned the fact that I had successfully completed courses and been graduated from Whittier College in California and Duke University Law School in Durham, North Carolina. He was very gracious in not mentioning that I did not graduate from the Electoral College. Flunk debating. Also, I was most interested in the way President Jacobs of the law school and of the student body introduced Dr. Reitz. He said that he had just returned from Tallahassee from what he thought was a successful battle on the budget. I have a warning for him. If he's too successful, they may ask him to come to the University of California and fight that battle on the budget. Tonight, I realize that this is a program which is unusual in American universities, although it is becoming certainly more common as a result of successfully experimenting in many other institutions. I had the privilege of appearing at Vanderbilt last year. And when I received the invitation, and after I noted the invitation list, I tried to think of the reasons that I was selected. Let me give you two or three. I think, first of all, since this is a program that has to do with dissent, it was thought that there should be a granting of equal time. After all, I was thinking that in October I spoke at the University of Miami, so I have equal time at Florida tonight. And then, two, I recall the fact that Senator Smathers, a Democrat, spoke last night, opened the program, and that previously Vice President Humphrey has visited this campus. Now, I would not hesitate to say that I have the greatest respect for both Vice President Humphrey and Senator Smathers, but certainly in view of the fact that Florida now has a Republican governor. One Republican ought to be on the program for accent, so I'm here tonight. I should also mention the fact that another reason I'm glad to be here is that I attended the Orange Bowl game this year as the guest of the Orange Bowl committee. They put me on the Georgia Tech side of the stadium. I'm glad to be on the winner's side for a change up here in Florida. And as a long-suffering New York Giant fan, believe me, get Spurrier up there as fast as you can. We need him. We couldn't even stay in the same field now with the Kansas City Chiefs, let alone the Miami Dolphins. We could use it. But in any event, to come to the more serious questions for the evening, I did mention in passing Senator Smathers and Vice President Humphrey, and I have two comments about these gentlemen that I would like to make. I entered the Congress 20 years ago with George Smathers. I served with him in the House and then in the Senate. I presided over the Senate during the 8 years I was Vice President when he was a distinguished member of that body. As you know, he leaves public service this year. I can tell you, speaking as a Republican about a Democrat, that I know of no man in the United States Senate, Republican or Democrat, over the years, who is more respected as a fine, honest public servant than George Smathers. And I know that this man, who is a graduate of this university, one who has a distinguished record in the state of Florida, leaves public life now, and speaking as a Republican in a nonpartisan and I hope bipartisan way, I hope sometime he returns in one capacity or as another. I would prefer not running against a Republican, however, if he could find a way to do it. And then as far as Vice President Humphrey is concerned, I know that he's been taking his lumps lately. I'm sort of an expert on vice presidents, you know. I have noticed, too, and I state tonight that I, for one, believe that he's been taking his lumps for the wrong reasons. I mean by that that the reason he seems to have gone down in public opinion polls is because he's doing what a good vice president ought to do, support his president. And as he supports his president, and as he supports his president, and as the president's popularity goes down, his popularity goes down with it. I can think of poor Hubert, I call him that, as he calls me Dick, and I've been called much worse, incidentally, so I appreciate being called Dick. But I can think of how poor Hubert must feel now. Here he was after that great election victory in 1964, dreaming of the future. 8 years as vice president, and then in 1972, he as the heir apparent runs for president. That wonderful dream. And then it turned it into a nightmare. And Bobby Kennedy comes floating across the television. Now it looks though Bobby is going to get the Democratic nomination in 72, if not in 68. Matter of fact, Hubert can't even get the vice presidential nomination. Bobby's promised that to Teddy. But to come to more serious subjects, I can only say that both of these gentlemen may wake up from their dreams in November 1968 and find a Republican elected as President of the United States. So who knows? Now, I give you these political comments at the outset because I understood from the chairman of this meeting beforehand that you had been told that your questions should be limited to the subject of my remarks. Now, I have covered virtually every subject by innuendo or otherwise at the outset, so feel free to ask any questions you like, and don't limit them to the very serious subject that I now would like to discuss in some detail. That subject naturally before an audience like this on a great university campus is the future. That gives me plenty of leeway because it could cover so many different facets of the future. I've been reading recently, as I'm sure some of you have, a fascinating series of articles in the Wall Street Journal. These articles deal with the future. And what the journal did was to select some experts around the country and have them analyze progress in various fields and predict what the United States would be like in the year 2000, just 34 years from now. Those predictions are indeed fascinating. They all may not come true, but most of them probably will. For example, there will be planes flying 4,000 miles an hour, carrying 250 people at least in each one. That means going to Alaska or to Hawaii from this coast in 2 hours. There will probably be video telephones. I'm not sure that for some that will be an unmixed blessing. I was thinking of those fellows, you know, that call home and say, "Sorry, dear, I'm working late at the office." And she says, "Who's that bunny sitting on your lap?" There will be, too, probably a formula which will be economically viable for the conversion of seawater into freshwater, with all that that means to the problems of population and food, etc., for the less developed areas of the world. There will be, and indeed certainly, progress in the field of health, perhaps a cure for cancer, so that we live longer, if not better. We're going to have, and this is an exciting possibility, instead of having farms that stretch out for miles and miles across arid or watered plains, we will have skyscraper farms where perfect products are grown under perfect conditions with chemical and other devices to bring them along. These are just some of the projections. I advise you to read the articles if you have not. And then I would also suggest that you note that there is a box accompanying each article, a small one, but in boldface type, which reads as follows. Men have always speculated about the future, both for fun and for more practical reasons. Wall Street Journal reporters have talked to experts in many fields to get the best informed opinions on probable developments between now and the year 2000. This is one of a series of articles based on their answers, and then this, all of which of necessity are premised on the assumption that the Earth will not be incinerated in a nuclear war during the next generation. And that, of course, is the subject of primary interest to this generation, because we can have the finest solutions to the problems of health and production and travel and communication that any people can possibly imagine. It isn't going to make any difference if we're not around to enjoy them. Now, at this point, it would be customary before an audience of this type to speak of the dire developments and the dire prospects as far as the possibilities of keeping the peace without surrender of freedom are concerned. I could speak at some length about those problems. Let me summarize it perhaps in a few words by suggesting that if you were to take a map of the world and put it up on a wall and then stand back a few paces and throw darts at it, it would be difficult to hit any place in the world today where the United States isn't having trouble or where the cause of peace and freedom isn't under a very grave threat. Europe, for example, that great alliance fashioned 20 years ago, nurtured for 10 years after that, now in a shambles with the British going one way and the French another and the Germans another, turning possibly toward independence, even worse, toward neutralism, if not leaning toward policies vis-a-vis the Soviet bloc that we could not approve. Africa, in many parts in chaos. Castro still in Cuba, more strongly entrenched, at least militarily more strong than he was 6 years ago. The Near East, still a tinderbox. India and Pakistan, despite perhaps the most useless war, if any war is useful, this was the most useless, certainly, in history, in the tragic. And yet India and Pakistan, still there, ready to go at each other's throats once they have the wherewithal to do so. Looking at the communist bloc, reports that the Soviet Union may have developed or may be in the process of developing an effective anti-missile missile system, which would mean, by the projections of some military experts, that by 1968, or at least by 1970, assuming that the Soviet Union would still have the initiative which we give them of striking first, that then they would have passed the point of parity with us and would be in a position to blackmail their way around the world. Communist China, despite its internal difficulties, nevertheless in a position where within 4 years, possibly 5 years, it will have intermediate missiles which can deliver nuclear warheads to a period, to an area within 1,500 miles of the Chinese Communist mainland, which would mean that they would be in a position then, assuming the diplomatic situation is the same then as it is now, that they could blackmail the United States and other free nations out of the Pacific area and make the Pacific a Red Sea. These and other current appraisals are enough to frighten those who think of the future, what America will be like, what the world will be like in the year 2000. But then there's another side to it. And I would prefer tonight to dwell for a moment also on the hopes of the world, those powers, those forces which can be mobilized for peace with freedom in this last third of the 20th century. We could mention here also many things. We take that same Europe, which is now divided, going off in different directions. We compare that Europe with the Europe of 20 years ago, and we realize that the reason that Europe is having these difficulties is because our aid programs and their use of that aid has been so effective. And we find that Europe today, if it were united, would be a powerful economic and political and military entity, more powerful than any in the world except for the United States. And so this potential power on the side of peace and the side of freedom is there if it can be mobilized. We look at the problems, for example, in the communist world. Too often, I think, we examine our own difficulties and we overlook what is happening on the other side. Here is the Soviet Union, 20 years ago, with monolithic control over the communist bloc. And now, Eastern Europe tending to break away, not completely, and we're still a long way off when you can say that there is real autonomy in other Eastern European countries, as there appears to be, for example, in Yugoslavia, vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. But whether it's in Poland or Romania or even Hungary, there are more and more evidences of latent nationalism tending to pull out away from the control of the communist power from Moscow. We find that China, I speak of communist China, despite its growing nuclear capability, has tremendous internal problems. How grave they are, what the outcome will be, nobody will know until it happens, until observers can visit there to see. But the fact that they do exist is an indication that this power is not necessarily one which 3 to 4 to 5 years from now can be directed against the United States or any other free nations in that area. And looking all over the world, we see other powers for peace. Let's look at the United Nations for a moment. Any sophisticated person would recognize that the United Nations is most ineffective when it comes to dealing with major powers. I think those who set it up did not really believe that it ever, or at least in this time, would be effective in that respect. But in dealing with those small conflicts between smaller nations, which can explode into bigger wars, witness how World War II came about, the UN is an effective instrument for peace. It can be made more effective if we can develop new formulas, new programs there. Looking also at the power that can destroy, the power of atomic weapons and nuclear weapons and all the sophisticated ways that they can be used, we realize too that this is an immense deterrent to war, a deterrent because those who have these weapons know that their use runs the risk of national suicide. And finally, as the power for peace, we see the United States of America. And that brings me to the basic message I would like to leave, particularly with those who are members of the undergraduate and graduate student bodies today. Reams upon reams of words have been written about this historic period in which we now enter, the last third of the 20th century. And those in the graduating classes in the year 2000 will be only 2 or 3 years older than I am today. And you will live through these exciting times. We hope you will live through them. And as we look at this last third of the 20th century, I believe it is most important for us to recognize how very fortunate we are in one sense. Let me simply, by way of reference, make one thing very clear. I remember in my college years, I could not have resented more those convocation speeches and graduation speeches which had either one of the theme or another. Either this was the best of all possible times or the worst of all possible times, and do what you can to make it better or make it worse or whatever the case might be. All that I'm suggesting is that this is no time to be a Pollyanna, but I do say this. Do you realize that this is the first time in America's history when we are the masters of our fate? Oh, not completely. But look at the 20th century, the century in which I have lived and you are living. In the first third of this century, the United States was a strong nation, but we were not the masters of our fate. What happened in the capitals of Europe, in London, in Berlin, in Paris, determine the future of peace in the world in that first third of the 20th century. In the second third of the 20th century, America was even stronger, but we were not then the masters of our fate as we are today, because then still, as you will remember, what happened in Europe and then in Moscow and in Tokyo determined whether we were to have peace or whether we were to have war. And now comes the last third of this century. In the United States, whether we want it or like it or not, the United States, because of its economic power and its military power and its political power, now is the only nation in the world which can stop those aggressor nations who still have not recognized that war should be outlawed as an instrument of national policy, particularly in view of the fact that of its devastating consequences in the event that it develops into a nuclear war. No other nation can do it. No other nation in the free world has the power. And so here we are, with all of this power, and with the rest of the free world and all of the neutral world looking to us for leadership. And a word about the neutrals. I'm often somewhat amused by comments to the effect that neutral nations object to American policy in one way or another. Not that their objections should not be listened to, and not that sometimes their objections do not have merit. But when the subject involves, for example, an American commitment as it does in Vietnam, let us remember just one thing. that no nation in the world today could afford the luxury of neutrality if it were not for the power of the United States of America. It is the United States. It does not mean that the United States should use that power without regard to what neutral nations, weaker nations, or other free nations may think. But it does mean that the United States, as the strongest nation, must sometimes make decisions and carry them out, which weaker nations do not have the power to carry out. But moving from that aside to the basic theme, here is the United States with all of this power. And the question is, what do we do with it? How can we use it? Are we going to have the wisdom to develop the political institutions which in turn will develop the superior leadership, which in turn will produce the decisions, avoiding war and keeping peace? Naturally, it isn't easy. Let me touch briefly on one area in which it is particularly difficult and in which it is a current subject, and I refer to the problem of Vietnam. There'll be disagreement in this audience, as in every American audience, on whether we should have gone into Vietnam, whether we're doing the right thing now there, and what we ought to do in the future. Therefore, since this is a program in which dissent is respected, and those of you who disagree, of course, can prepare for present your views in the question period, let me tell you why I believe that Vietnam represents one of those great turning points in history, a turning point which, unfortunately for us, involves a most unpopular war, a most difficult war, but I'm afraid a most necessary one. Let's look at it. What is the war about? Let me oversimplify, if I may. I remember when the Korean War began, I talked to a